Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
We are taking a break from Cindy today. Instead, it's time for my June installment of Intimate Partner Homicides in Canada in 2018. Now, you might accuse me of cheating on this one because today's case isn't actually an intimate partner homicide, but it is very much a domestic homicide in which the two parties live under the same roof, in close proximity, and in your own home or apartment, you have the right to feel safe and secure. However, I discovered that within the horrors of this case, there is a testimony from a father that will literally break your heart into a million pieces that you may never recover. So I'm going to warn you about that before I tell that part, because you might not want to hear it if you're particularly sensitive to other people's trauma. Most of my information today comes from court documents, but there was a really great article in the Toronto Star by Alicia Hasman and Wendy Gillis, who did some digging and sussed up out some other details on some background information, which is really appreciated. And I think that their hard work deserves to be cited here. This is the murder of Victoria Selby Reedman.
Obviously, have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
Victoria was born on September 11th in 1989 to her parents Genevieve and Gary in Etobicoke, Ontario. The small family moved to Mississauga when she was very little before settling in a small town of Caledon, of the Caledon Boys mystery that we discussed a few weeks ago, which, as a reminder, is just a bit north of Toronto. She went to Mayfield High, and the pretty and vivacious brunette was a popular and well-liked teenager. When she graduated, she attended the University of Toronto, where she moved right into the downtown core, where she could enjoy the busyness and commotion of the big city. And there she met her best friend, Alexandra Palermo, and the two were soon inseparable. Victoria had always been independent in nature and strong-willed, but she was also very sensitive to other people and was wildly intelligent, and her intelligence and sensitivity gave her a talent for story writing that became her passion. She was a huge fan of Sylvia Plath and Edgar Allan Poe, so she often focused the short stories that she wrote on the horror genre. In university, Victoria had studied women's studies, literature, philosophy, and political sciences, so she was very well read, and her interests were broad and really about life and people and how we all worked and lived and were connected with each other. Alexandra said of Victoria, "She had such a sharp mind, she was the smartest person I knew." Alexandra and Victoria had worked on a film screenplay, and to make ends meet while she got her writing career off the ground, she was taking shifts as a bike courier in the downtown core. Her parents later divorced at some point, and her mom remarried Barry Brillinger in Caledon, and Gary moved to Toronto to be closer to Victoria and partnered up with a woman named Suzette Corey. Gary and Victoria had shared an apartment in Toronto at 798 Richmond Street West until January of 2018, when he moved out, likely to move in with Suzette and give Victoria her independence. Gary was still on the lease even when he moved out, as they didn't bother to make changes to it, and she continued to be very close with her father, who was considered one of her best friends. So they texted or called each other on a daily basis. And when Gary moved out, Victoria moved in her boyfriend to share the rent, but unfortunately that arrangement didn't work out for long, and he moved out in April of 2018. So Victoria needed a roommate to share the rent on the apartment, because as much as she would love to have just lived with her and her cat Bunny, cats don't pay rent, unfortunately. And with the housing issues in Toronto, she didn't have to advertise on the Facebook group that she chose for very long, when she had a list of potential roommates. Now, there's really no reporting or anything in the court documents that suggests why she chose 44-year-old Richard Isaac as her new roommate, but it was likely that he had come across as a normal and put-together guy. He had a job in construction but was currently injured, but he had money coming in from EI and was well-dressed and groomed, especially for a laborer, and had recently separated from his girlfriend, who had left him with no place to live, and he was making life a hell for him, and he needed a place in the city until he could find something more suitable for him and his teenage son and daughter that he had from his first marriage. His mother had passed away less than a year before, and his dad was having some health issues, so he likely came across as sympathetic and in need of a break, but also someone that could pay the rent and wouldn't be around much anyways. So Richard Isaac moved in about halfway through the month of May. But within a short time, Victoria started to notice that Richard was a bit of a drinker, and he got stupid when he drank. She wasn't afraid of him, but she just didn't like the way he acted when he was drinking, and she started to spend less time at home to try to avoid him. But Victoria hadn't really confided much to her dad about it, only mentioning that she didn't think this new arrangement was going to work out and that she was probably going to have to ask him to leave. But she had been confiding to her best friend Alexandria a bit more directly, sending her his Facebook details, saying in sort of a joking but not joking way, "You need to know who this guy is in case it gets crazy, because no one knows he's here." And only 3 days after he had moved in, she sent Alexandria a text saying, quote, "I want to kick this fucking idiot out of my place. He's so annoying. He's crazy yelling at his ex-girlfriend literally all fucking night." On June 7th, 2018, Alexandra and Victoria took Alexandra's dog Sky out for a walk and sat at a picnic table outside of Alexandra's house discussing their plans for the writing and the screenplay that they had written and how she was going to get Richard out of her apartment. She told Alexandria that if it turned out that Richard got mad or seemed like he might become violent, she would get to security and have them call the police if it ever came to that, but she was pretty sure it wasn't like that. Tenants' laws are pretty rough, and that wasn't going to be easy, but between her and her dad and Alexandria, they felt that they could get the job done. On June 8th at 5:06, she sent a text to her dad saying, "My roommate is drunk again. I need support. He's so stupid. I want him gone today." The next evening at 4:03, when Gary asked how the day had gone and if she had told him to leave and what had happened, how's it going type of thing, Victoria appeared to have sort of changed her mind about it and realized that Richard was just going through sort of a patch of sorts, and she wrote back, "Good, actually. He's taking me out for supper. I asked him not to drink anymore and he agreed with me. He's a nice guy. I just hate seeing him drink over his ex. She's not worth it, and he's only hurting himself. When he's sober, he's so kind and thoughtful. This week he brought me flowers. Okay, I gotta get ready for supper." And Gary thought, well, that's weird. I mean, it's good that she figured out that it's been kind of resolved, but why does she sound so weird? Like, supper. Like, since when do we call it supper? It's always been dinner. And why would he buy her flowers? Like, that's strange. The whole thing was strange, but Gary was relieved for the most part that she had worked out the issue with him, at least for now. Gary didn't hear from Victoria the next day to tell him how their dinner or supper or whatever had gone. So on Sunday, June 11th, he sent her a text to check in and sort of let her know that he was off work that week from Monday to Wednesday, and ended it, his text, saying, "Love you, buddy," like he always did. And she still didn't respond, nor at his attempts to call her. She wasn't picking up. It was just going to voicemail, and she didn't respond to his text the next day either. So Gary figured she must have some issue with her cell phone or something, because it wasn't normal for her not to answer him. It's not like she was or could have been mad at him or ignoring him. So he figured he'd pop over to the apartment and check in on what's the problem with the phone. So on Tuesday, which was the 12th, he went over and knocked on the apartment door, but there wasn't any answer other than her cat Bunny meowing from the other side of the door. So Gary had, he had a key at his house, so he went back to home to get it and planned on coming back, hoping in the meantime that Victoria would have returned from wherever she was, because he wasn't really liking the feeling that he was getting in his stomach that he was starting to get, because something just wasn't right. But he wasn't able to find the key. So now more than ever, he's starting to feel like he really needed to be inside the apartment. So because of his name still being on the lease, he stopped at security on his way in this time and asked them to let him in.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Once he got inside, he wasn't quite sure what he was taking in. Like, his mind considered options about what he might find. So this is the part that you might not want to listen to. There was a blanket propping up like a mask against a wall. He knew Victoria had been working on one of her horror stories, but why did she need props? She wasn't actually making the movie. She was just writing the screenplay. Gary later testified about his discovery, saying, quote, "There was this horrible looking head. It frightened me. I didn't know what it was. So thinking it was a grotesque mask for one of her stories, he tried to pull the mask off, like unzip what he thought was some kind of costume bodysuit. And then he just suddenly realized it was a human body. In a moment of, I don't even know what thoughts are going through this poor man's head, he saw that one of Victoria's shoes was lying on the floor nearby. So he grabbed it and he held it against the foot of this body with this horrible mask. And when he saw the sole of the shoe that just kind of slid neatly and evenly along the foot that was sticking out from the blanket, quote, I called 911. At this point, I'm aware it's my daughter, so I hugged her and I held her. And when the police arrived, they implored him to leave the scene, but he said, I'm not leaving until my daughter is. And so he stayed with his daughter until she was lifted onto a stretcher and zipped into a body bag for her final journey to the medical examiner's office. And what the medical examiner found was gruesome. Victoria had injuries to her head, face, and neck, not just bruises, but fractures to her jaw bones, skull, and her neck. When Victoria had been found, it was a couple of days after they believed she had died, and there had been a significant amount of blood found pooled under her body. The forensic pathologist, Dr. Michael Pickup, concluded based on the blood and where and what her injuries had been, that she had essentially been beaten until she fell to the ground and then stomped to death. Richard had been nowhere around when Gary stumbled upon his viciously tortured body of Victoria. Security video showed Victoria entering the apartment at 5:55 p.m. on the Friday, June 8th, and was not seen again. Richard came and went a few times after that on the 10th of June, appearing to be making trips for alcohol purchases. He was last seen on the morning of Monday, June 11th, carrying three pretty full black garbage bags, rushing out of the building and getting into a vehicle driven by another person. Now, obviously, that looks terribly suspicious on its own, but when investigators ran Richard Isaac's name, It turns out there was a warrant for his arrest already. And for what, you ask? Domestic assault, of course. He was wanted by the Durham Regional Police for harassing and threatening to kill his ex-girlfriend, and also for violating his probation from a 2017 assault on a different ex-girlfriend, whom he took her phone from and smashed it, preventing her from calling the police on him. In fact, in the short span of time he had been living with Victoria, he was also continuing this harassment of his ex-girlfriend, continuing to call her and threaten her. Things were so bad that when the ex's boss accompanied her to the police station to make a report, he actually called. When the officer answered her phone, Richard just laughed. And the girlfriend's boss, Renee John is her name, told them that this was going to end badly. And that was on May 23rd, so less than 10 days after he had moved in. After Richard's arrest, a barrage of women came forward that he had been harassing, that he met on dating apps and Facebook, leading to someone to creating a Facebook page called Ladies Beware of Richard Isaac. But that wasn't all. It turns out Richard had a rather lengthy criminal record dating back to 1991, and in those past 22 years had spent 16 of them on probation for some reason or another. So let's just go through some of the activities Richard had gotten up to before fooling Victoria with his sob story of just being a newly single dad in need of a place to stay. On December 12, 1991, mischief over $1,000, sentenced to probation for 1 year and 30 hours of community service. That was in the District of Peel, so he would have been about 16 at this time, so it was a youth charge. September 9, 1992, mischief under $1,000, theft under $1,000, and failure to comply with disposition, which is a breach of a probation order. 44 days in open custody and 18 months of probation. He was under 18 still, so open custody just means like a youth facility where you can still attend school. And that was also in the District of Peel. Then he moves on to Brampton. And in January 1995, there was an over, he was over 18. He was charged with forcible confinement and sexual assault. He got only 2 months, which was considered time served, and then 2 years of probation. And by May 27, 1996 in Brampton, he started a list of violent offenses of the domestic sort against his wife. And rather than ramble off his list of dates and offenses, let's just sort of sum up some of these into as much information as I have on the incidents themselves, thanks to Alyssa and Wendy from the Toronto Star, who pulled the court documents on these prior offenses. Now, most of these incidents happened in Brampton, and then we move on to Orangeville, and then the last one's in Toronto. And after a September 1998 charge of assault, the judge told Richard, "I fear very much, sir, that regardless of your sincerity and how upset you are, that you are inherently a dangerous man and you cannot control yourself." There were a total of 8 incidences that were considered violent or threats against his intimate partners. One of those apparently was a rather graphic and explicit threat against his own teenage son. 2 of these incidences involved kicking the victim while they were down on the ground, and of course, numerous breaches of probation and court orders, including violating restraining orders. His drinking was listed as a big factor in pretty much all of his offenses. His wife and him stayed married for 20 years, and for 20 years she endured his abuse until the final offense in October of 2014, after which she filed for divorce and he moved on to other victims. In this October 2014 incident, him and his wife had gotten into an argument at a basketball game, and he was yelling at her in the car until they got home. And when they did make it home, he kicked her 3 times. She managed to run to a neighbor's to call 911. She told her children, who were still fairly young then, to run in case he took his rage out on them. Police learned from the son that he had grabbed him by the shirt collar and said, "If I come back, I'm going to kill you. I'll cut your throat and rip your heart out." He did spend some time in jail for that without bail, waiting for this hearing, and had a no contact order on him, but he started to write letters to the house, which he addressed as if they were written to his mom, who was deceased at the time, but they were clearly written to be read by his wife, asking to reconcile and promises to be better. In that matter, he was convicted of 1 count of assault, uttering threats, and breaching a restraining order, so he got 11 months in jail and 3 years of probation. After his divorce in 2016, he met a woman on Tinder, but she tried to break it off with him after a few weeks, but he continued to text her, show up at her house one night, banging on the door. She called the police. He took off. But she did continue to see him again after that, probably after tears and apologies that he was going to be a better man and it wouldn't happen again, and other bullshit that wasn't true. But the woman hoped would be. She tried again to break up with him in April of 2017 when he started yelling at her, and when she told him to leave that she was calling the cops on him, he grabbed her phone, pinned her to the couch so that she couldn't leave. Now, fortunately, her landlord heard the commotion and called the police for her. In that case, he was again charged with assault, mischief, under $5,000, and forcible confinement. He was told, as part of his bail conditions, to live with his father and to make sure he was always home between 6 and 5 a.m., but that didn't last long. In October of 2017, he was back on Tinder, met another woman, and moved into her Toronto condo with her, and repeatedly assaulted her over the next few weeks until mid-November, when the police were called and filed charges of assault, forcible confinement, and mischief, and violating those pesky bail conditions by not being at his dad's house where he belonged. But in March 2018, so only about 2 months before he answered Victoria's Facebook ad, she recanted her police statement and the charges were dropped. But he pled guilty to breaching his bail conditions. It turns out she had dropped the charges because he called her from jail telling her that he loved her and he would never hurt her again. And the courts did their best that they could do in that case and issued a restraining order that the girlfriend had the option to rescind. Richard told the court that they would be applying to have it lifted right away. And Justice Cawley in that case told the couple together, if you don't think you've got a circle on your back, a nice mark with an X, if you don't think the cops are looking out for you, you're kidding yourself. That record gives them impetus to say that's a bad apple. Later that same month, Richard was given a suspended sentence for his charges related to his previous girlfriend with 2 years of probation. And so the couple got back together, but of course it didn't go particularly well, shocker. And in early May, her brother-in-law called the cops on him from their house in Ajax. Not that he was being violent, but that he was so drunk he needed medical attention. So they arrested him because they looked at his record and assumed there was a probation order prohibiting him from drinking. Only it turns out there actually wasn't that condition on him, so they had to release him that same day. And 6 days later, on May 12th, police got a call about a couple arguing in the basement apartment, and he was threatening her. But when the police got there, they found that he was actually just yelling at the poor woman on the phone, and she wasn't actually present. Police spoke to the brother-in-law again, who told them that his sister-in-law had been staying with a friend, but that he'd been calling both of them repeatedly, but she didn't want him to get into trouble with the police, so she hadn't filed any charges. So the police went back to the house where the call had come from to arrest Richard, but he had peaced out and he wasn't there. So the Durham police sent a message to the Peel police to try and arrest him at his father's house in Brampton and contacted Richard by phone to tell him to turn himself in, that he was wanted on 2 counts of criminal harassment. But instead of turning himself in, on May 15th, he moved in with Victoria Reedman. And while he was living with Victoria and making her life miserable, he was continuing to harass his ex-girlfriend. In fact, the day after he moved in with Victoria, the ex-girlfriend called police because she suspected that Richard was creeping around her backyard. She had a log of 25 calls with messages that he had sent to her, which was a brief breach of his no contact order. She also had photos of the laptop that he had smashed of hers, and a couple of days later, he posted compromising private videos of her online. And you know how she found out about that? Well, her supervisor at work, Renee John, received them via the company's Facebook page, along with claims that the woman didn't have a degree for the work that she was doing to try and destroy her reputation. So that's when she went to the police station with the woman, and he called her there, and he laughed at the officer that answered the phone. He'd actually been calling her up to 100 times a day, threatening to kill her and her family. Then if she ever dated another man, he'd kill that man. Renee reiterated that Richard appeared to not care less that there was a warrant out for his arrest and wasn't exactly hiding from them. She told them that on June 5th that she had thought that he might be living in Harbor harbor front area of Toronto with a girl named Nikki. Now, according to Alexandria, it was around then that the woman got a hold of Victoria by text and told her that Richard was wanted by the police, which might have been the icing on the cake for Victoria and asking him to leave. Richard was actually found on the 16th of June at his dad's place in Felon Falls, living in a trailer that he owned on the property. Apparently, Richard had called his dad early in the morning of June 11th, the Monday, and told him that he couldn't stay there anymore and asked if his dad could pick him up. And that would be when he was seen on CCTV footage hightailing it out of the apartment building carrying three garbage bags of his belongings. But of course, Richard hadn't killed Victoria. That was nonsense. He had made sure to leave out in plain view in this trailer his journal. Like a lot of 44-year-old construction working men that beat their girlfriends, keep a journal of their feelings and thoughts in case you didn't know. And in this journal, which interestingly, he just on a whim decided to start writing on June 12th, he wrote about how he left the apartment on June 9th, go get some booze, and when he came back, he found Victoria beaten to death. He was so distraught that he threw up and then made sure to lock the door because he was scared for his life and that this maniac was going to come back for him. Her pants were pulled down to her ankles, and he didn't want her to be seen like that, so he pulled them back up for her and covered her with a blanket and some towels. Then, like any of us would, he stayed with her, going out just to buy booze as the need arose. And finally, after 3 days and nights with her lifeless corpse, called his dad to come and get him, mentioning none of it to his dad. Pictures were taken of Richard when he was arrested. He had a long scratch on the outer part of his right arm, and when his DNA was matched to some material under Victoria's fingernails, Richard Isaac was a perfect match. And he pled not guilty and maintained his innocence, forcing a full jury trial for the family, which is always complete with autopsy photos, pictures of the crime scene, including her body as it was found, and testimony from the medical examiner explaining the injuries and that he had been caused by a much bigger person stomping her and kicking her to death. And when the trial did start, it was, of course, in the middle of COVID. So unfortunately, family and friends and others that wanted to attend the trial were really limited. But they did provide a Zoom link for them to watch the proceedings virtually, which is what we were hoping for that they would do for Dustin's trial so that we could at least participate in some way. Although most of all, what we really wanted to do was stare him down. So I'm sure this was really disappointing for Gary and Victoria's mom, Genevieve, who everyone just refers to as Jenny. So they did the same as what we were sort of planning on doing, and that's rotate the attendees so that the jury could at least see that there were a lot of people that cared very much about Victoria. And under the jury that had been instructed by Justice Brian O'Mara, he was found guilty of second-degree murder. And after the verdict, Alexandria said, "I hope now Victoria can rest in peace knowing justice has been served. The verdict still doesn't take away any of the pain or how much we all love her and miss her every day. I will never get my best friend back, but I can now go through life knowing the man who killed her and robbed her of her beautiful life will be in jail and held accountable for what he has done. She was the missing piece that completed everybody. Now we are missing our piece. There was always light around her." And her cousin Sonny said, "I will never trust a roommate again. The women of our family feel unsafe, constantly looking over our shoulders." And Jenny, Victoria's mom, made sure to tell the courtroom, "Richard Isaac is an extremely dangerous man who possesses an enormous threat to others, particularly young women and their families. He has proven himself to be a manipulative predator capable of profound and unprovoked acts of violence that have resulted in serious harm and/or death to his victims." And Richard, for his part, did speak, but it was very hard to hear over Zoom. He basically said that he was innocent and that he felt really bad for the family. Now, I'm just going to try and summarize the reasons for sentencing that the justice gave, because it has some interesting things to say in general about the connection to domestic partner abuse and then just murder in general. Richard Isaac is 44 years old. He has worked sporadically in construction. Substance abuse related to alcohol and extreme anger issues form a pattern in his behavior. A tumultuous marriage punctuated by violent incidences against his former wife and son ended after 7 years. Violence or abuse directed at an intimate partner has specifically codified as an aggravating factor in sentencing. While there was not an intimate relationship here, the accused and the victim were involved in a personal relationship by virtue of sharing a small apartment. The victim was very vulnerable to be in such a confined space with a man much bigger and stronger than her. He has a proven history of violence against other women with whom he shared space. There was no escape from his wrath, and she could not defend himself. The conduct of the accused after the fact was cold and callous. I am satisfied, based on the constellation of circumstantial evidence, that the victim was killed on June 8th. She was dead on June 9th, and as the accused sent text messages on her phone to reply to her father. That was a cruel gambit to deflect any attention from what he had done to the victim. It was an attempt to lead her father to believe that all was well and that she was about to enjoy a friendly meal with the accused. Remaining in the apartment with the dead and battered body for over 48 hours and then leaving her without notifying any authorities was callous. Mr. Brodsky, who was his defense lawyer, did his best in submissions on sentence, but was hard-pressed to put forward any mitigating factors. Richard Isaac is not young, he's not a first offender, not a first-time violent offender against a woman in a confined space where he had an overwhelming physical advantage and power to dominate and inflict harm. The accused did not testify at trial. He had no obligation to do so. When counsel had finished their submissions on sentence, I asked him whether he wished to say anything. He then expressed some sympathy for the victim's family and friends, but also claimed that he is innocent of her death. He did not express remorse for his crime. He's entitled to assert and maintain his innocence. Absence of remorse is not an aggravating factor. It is the absence of what would otherwise be a mitigating factor. The accused also expressed doubt about whether the victim was in fact very vulnerable. I do not agree with or accept his comment on that issue for the reasons that I've set out in these reasons. Victoria Selby Reedman was a very vulnerable victim who did nothing to deserve the cruel death she suffered. The extreme level of violence by the accused towards this woman and his callous conduct after the fact must be denounced by this court. This type of case and this particular accused demand a significant degree of general and specific deterrence. By his criminal history and his conduct in this case, he presents a clear and continuing extreme danger to a particular class of potential victims. Any woman involved in a relationship with him, including a relationship short of intimacy, is in grave danger if she's in a confined space with him alone. For all of these reasons, parole ineligibility must be set towards the top end of the range permitted by the criminal code. So his final sentence was life with parole eligibility after 18 years, at which a woman called out over Zoom, "Have fun in jail, Richard." Oh, and that charge that he had a warrant out for him, that matter wasn't actually heard until March 18th, 2019. It was for criminal harassment, mischief under $5,000, and breaking his parole conditions. He got a suspended sentence for time served, which included the 2 years that he was in remand awaiting his murder charges, and then 2 years of probation, which you can't really be on probation while you're in prison, so I'm not really sure what the point of that is. We can hope that Richard Isaac dies in prison, but he'll only be 62 when he's eligible for parole, so it's not likely because chances are he'll get out and be the same asshat he was going in. I'd say do your background checks on potential roommates, but Victoria wasn't the problem here. I'd say the big problem is that he's running around with a warrant for violent offenses, of which I think everyone knew was going to lead to someone's death, and I don't think they did enough to find him before he moved into Victoria's apartment with her. You know, he wasn't hiding from the police. He should have been pretty easy to find. But in the end, with the stupid sentences that he was getting, he would have just broken another probation condition and still probably wound up on Victoria's doorstep. What an absolute menace to society this guy is. Sorry this episode was a little longer than I thought it would be. I'm going to be back again next week with the continuation of Cindy James, which I really hope that you're enjoying. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to conclude it in one or maybe two more episodes. No promises, but I really do hope that you're enjoying it. In the meantime, if you can do your rate review thing, but only if you like what I'm doing. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.